KOA News, I'm Tommy McNeil. The release of a redacted version of a special counsel Robert Mueller's nearly 400-page report on Russian meddling in the 2016 U.S. presidential election appears to be inevitable. Still, sparring over Mueller's conclusion is already rampant. Washington is expecting that Attorney General William Barr will disclose the report Monday or Tuesday. And the much-awaited details from the 22-month investigation of Donald Trump's campaign contacts with Russia and whether Mr. Trump, as president, obstructed justice by trying to thwart that probe. White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders told Fox News Sunday that she doesn't think it's going to be damaging to the president. Congressman Gerald Nadler, the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee that's probing the election, told CNN Sunday that Barr should release the full report and underlying investigatory evidence to his panel, but Barr has balked. Far from the den of Washington, Ivanka Trump toured businesses run by women in Ethiopia Sunday while promoting a White House global economic program for women. AP correspondent Julie Walker has more.
The White House senior advisor, who's President Trump's daughter and a businesswoman, visited a coffee shop and textile company in Addis Ababa, where she spoke with working women. It was her first stop on a four-day Africa trip to boost 50 million women in developing countries by 2025.
Investing in women is smart development policy, and it's smart business. It's also in our security interests, because women, when they're empowered, foster peace and stability.
This is Ivanka Trump's first visit to Africa since the president launched the Women's Global Development and Prosperity Initiative. I'm Julie Walker.
The British government's talks with the opposition Labour Party on a Brexit compromise is expected to continue, but will not last for months. That's according to the Cabinet Office Minister. This is VOA News. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says that he does not think the Venezuelan people will tolerate the Maduro regime much longer. Pompeo was on the last day of a four-nation tour of South America, where the economic and political calamity in Venezuela was among the top concerns during talks in Chile, Paraguay, Peru, and Colombia. Pompeo again said all options are on the table when it comes to U.S. involvement in Venezuela, but the Trump administration has not said yet under what circumstances it would use military action. The U.S. has already imposed a number of sanctions against some Venezuelan officials in the country's oil sector. Pompeo's stop in Colombia included a visit to the border city of Cúcuta, which is separated from Venezuela by a bridge. A video purporting to show Congresswoman Ilhan Omar being dismissive of the September 11th terrorist attacks has disappeared from President Trump's Twitter feed. AP correspondent Ben Thomas explains.
The video juxtaposes news footage of the 9/11 attacks with remarks Congresswoman Ilhan Omar made to the Council on American-Islamic Relations. It does not include Omar's full quote or the context of her comments, which were about Muslims feeling that their civil liberties had eroded after the attacks. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi had urged the president to take the video down, saying his words weigh a ton, and, quote, his hateful and inflammatory rhetoric creates real danger. Pelosi says she's taken steps to ensure that Capitol Police safeguard Omar, her family, and her staff. Ben Thomas, Washington.
Pete Buttigieg, the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, has become the latest Democrat to formally enter the crowded field of presidential candidates seeking to unseat President Trump in the 2020 election. The 37-year-old, who announced a presidential exploratory committee in January, made it official at a rally in South Bend Sunday. The Harvard and Oxford grad and Afghanistan war veteran has gone from being virtually unknown on the national political landscape to surging in recent polls, placing third behind former Vice President Joe Biden and Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. He's the son of an immigrant from Malta, and he attended Harvard College around the same time as Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg. Well, the former Malaysian Prime Minister Najib Razak returns to court on Monday as his trial over charges linked to a multi-billion-dollar scandal at State Fund 1 Malaysia Development Berhad continues and resumes. The highly anticipated trial began April 3rd, nearly a year after Malaysians voted Najib out of office in a general election marked by public disgust over allegations that about $4.5 billion was stolen from one MDB. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte, Washington. Today's Monday, April 1st. And here are some of the stories we are covering. For the first time in its 172-year history, Liberia has impeached a Supreme Court justice.
In keeping with Article 43 of the Liberian Constitution, the respondent has been found guilty of fraud, breach of duty as an impeachable offense.
Liberia Chief Justice Francis Corpoy, Gambia's president, denies allegations of misuse of development funds. An exiled Burundian journalist comments on the government's ban of the BBC and suspension of the VOA broadcast. We'll tell you about the unintended consequences of European migration restrictions and new allegations of political violence ahead of Malawi's May 21st presidential election.
They were in a group of probably more than 100 and descended on me and started beating me up. So I ran to the police and they reported the matter. As usual, there's nothing that has happened from our police.
Joseph Chidante Malunga is the spokesman of the United Transformation Movement Party, and financial challenges forced the closure of a South Sudan university. Those the report Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. For the first time ever in its 172-year history, Liberia last Friday impeached a sitting Associate Justice of the Supreme Court. By a unanimous vote, the Senate voted to remove Associate Justice Kabina Janet from the bench for gross breach of duty. But as Moses Gazier will report from Monrovia, Associate Justice Janet's impeachment has been greeted with dismay by some Liberians.
Also charged official misconduct and gross breach of duty, the Senate voted him guilty.
That was Senator Henry Yala, Secretary of the Jewel of Fight, reading the guilty verdict on Friday against Supreme Court Associate Justice Kabina Janet for gross breach of duty and misuse of office. Justice Janet was found guilty for granting a writ of prohibition petition filed by petroleum dealers in Liberia to stop the government from collecting a United States dollar 25 cents road tax imposed on pump price of petroleum products when he served as justice in chambers. For 17 days, prosecuting and defense lawyers argued the merit of the case, but the senators were the last arbiter. A unanimous vote of 22 senators voted to remove Janet, as was upheld by the presiding Chief Justice Francis Corpoy in conformity with Article 43 of the Liberian Constitution.
And a vote of 22 senators has been keeping with Article 43 of the Liberian Constitution, the respondent has been found guilty of fraud, breach of duty as an impeachable offense.
Prior to announcing the verdict, defense lawyers objected on grounds that the process were not carried out in line with the Senate rules governing the trial. Their motion was, however, rejected by the presiding Chief Justice Francis Corpoy.
I have not found that in the voting process of the Liberian Senate any irregularity took place that would warrant the setting aside of this verdict.
A smiling Associate Justice Janet was escorted out of the chambers of the Senate, accompanied by his lawyers and celebrated by many sympathizers. His lead defense lawyer, Arthur Johnson, who refused to be interviewed, could only say this to the VOA.
In their wisdom, they said today that Justice Janet is impeached. We leave them with the posterity of the history of this nation. That's all I can say. Let the Liberian people be the judges of the decision that the Senate took.
The impeachment of Associate Justice Janet was the first ever in the 172-year history of Liberia. However, not all of the senators voted yes to impeach Justice Janet. One of the senators who did not vote was Kamina Wise of Rewaji County. He had earlier released a statement withdrawing from the voting process.
This is not something against Kabina Janet. This is an assault on our democracy. It's assault on our constitution, and we all must stand up and show that this must end.
Many Liberians followed the impeachment with interest and expected an outcome that would keep Janet on the Supreme Court bench, but many of them felt disappointed by the verdict.
He performed a constitutional duty. Why will you impeach your constitutional duty? The other bill that the Democrats here, can somebody go in a session now to impeach any senator? Can somebody do that? He just said they cannot stop happened?
We are disheartened as people of Nimba, especially so when we have been following the case and trying to governors whatever assistance required to give our brother is a fair and just judgment.
Former Associate Justice Kabine Jane was in August 2018 impeached by the House of Representatives on four counts ranging from abuse of judicial power, theft of property, among others. The embattled former Associate Justice Jane himself took to the stand and pleaded not guilty to all the charges. Moses Gazeu, VOA News, Monrovia.
In the Gambia, accusations and counter-accusations are abound following the sacking of Vice President Usainu Dabo and two cabinet ministers from his United Democratic Party. Sacked Trade Minister Amadou Sané has alleged that President Adama Barrow might be dipping his hands into the $1.7 billion National Development Fund program to bankroll his party's youth movement. But as Pandero Mbaye reports, the Gambian government has debunked the accusations.
SAC Trade Minister Amadou Sané has been unleashing attacks against President Adama Barrow following his removal from cabinet. Sané has questioned the sincerity and honesty of President Adama Barrow as the leader of the Gambia. He says Barrow has no interest in transforming the Gambia other than his own personal interests. He says he is not aware of any budget that was allocated to the Barrow National Youth Movement as an organization. He also says there is no record to show the main source of funding for Barrow's youth movement. Sané says Barrow couldn't afford his lavish lifestyle prior to ascending to the presidency. He therefore challenged Barrow to explain where he's getting money to buy vehicles and motorbikes for his youth movement. He alleged that Barrow might be taking money from the 1.7 billion NDP funds for the Gambia. Ibrahim Aji Sankare is the spokesperson for the Gambian government.
As far as President Barrow is concerned, the allegations are just actually unfounded. And according to President Barrow, Amadou Sané had served in two cabinet capacities. First, as finance minister for 2 years almost, and thereafter as trade minister. If he has evidence of corrupt practices emanating from the president, particularly dealing with the president, President Barrow welcomes Mr. Sané to come forward and share his evidence with the Gambian people.
Amadou Sané was serving time in jail prior to Barrow coming to power. He was accused of aiding fake asylum seekers during Jammeh's rule. It was President Barrow who freed him from jail. Sané has been talking to the media since his firing. He had doubled down on his claims that Barrow might be using the NDP funds to consolidate a political base for himself.
The Barrow Youth for National Development, well, only because it uses the president's name, has elicited sometimes unwarranted political criticism.
Government spokesperson Sankare has also dismissed claims made by Amadou Sané that President Barrow has monopolized private investment in the Gambia. He says one of the reasons why investment was transferred to the state house was to combat corruption. For VOA Daybreak Africa, this is Pandeli Mbaye reporting.
It is 50 days before Malawi's May 21st presidential and parliamentary elections. Several candidates are trying to unseat incumbent President Arthur Peter Mutharika. There has been an uptake in political violence ahead of the vote, mostly against members of the opposition who accuse supporters of the ruling Democratic Progressive Party for the violence. President Mutharika earlier this year urged police to stamp down on any rogue elements. But on Sunday, Joseph Chidante Malunga, spokesman for the opposition United Transformation Movement, UTM Party, led by Vice President Saulos Chilima, says he was attacked by cadets of the ruling UPP.
I was in my hometown, and we were putting up flags of our party. It is always the tradition here that you hang flags around for you to display your messages. Somehow, the ruling party was also around the same area, conducting a rally. So they demanded that our flags should be pulled down. We said, you know, because this is a campaigning period, we are allowed by law to hang our flags, and there is no point that we should pull down our flags. They insisted, and they started putting them down on their own. At that moment, they confronted me, and they started beating me up. They were in a group of probably more than 100, and descended on me and started beating me up. So I ran to the police and they reported the matter. As usual, there's nothing that has happened from our police.
The Malawi election is coming up on May 21st. Who is behind political violence?
Well, largely, it's the ruling party that is perpetrating these acts of violence. Because each time we hear cases of violence, it's the ruling party that is involved. And also, largely, it's our party, UTM, that is a victim most of the times. So we get beaten up left and right as UTM. And this is caused by the ruling party.
The campaign is in full swing. How do you think your candidate and the current VP, Mr. Chiliman, how is your party doing in the campaign so far?
We are doing extremely fine, and we are ahead of everyone. They are scared of us. I think that's why they want to beat us left and right, because they know that right now, Malawians, come 21st May 2019, they are going to elect President Chima. So everyone knows this. I mean, go to the villages, go to town centers, go everywhere across the country. It's the Chima, in the Chima's name and the UTM. So they know we are only like 50 days to go. That's why they like to use every means to scare people off and things like that.
You said your party is doing very well. Where is your party in comparison to Mr. Chakwera, who is in an alliance with former President Joyce Banda?
You see, these parties you're talking about, the part of Chakwera, Malawi Congress Party, and another one, Dr. Joyce Banda, both of them are tribal parties, meaning that you go to a certain corner of the country, you look at a certain tribe, and then you get support from there. But UTM is across the country, across tribal lines, across anything else you can think of in Malawi. That's why it has resonated very well with the people, because it's not looking at anybody's tribe. It's not looking at any political boundary in the countries.
Mr. Malunga, we thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Joseph Chidante Malunga is the spokesman of the United Transformation Movement, UTM Party, led by Vice President Saulos Chilima. He was speaking with me from the capital, Lilongwe. Malawi's Information Minister Nicholas Dawusi says allegations of politically motivated violence by cadets of the ruling Democratic Progressive Party are false. Mr. Dawusi says the accusations are intended to win political sympathy.
It's not correct. It's not true. These are simply allegations that someone went to create sympathy to be seen that is victimized. But the truth remains that how can the ruling party make up for two viruses? That's not true. It's not true. Because they could have complained to the police.
Nicola Dawusi is the Malawi's information minister. He was speaking with me from the capital, Lilongwe. Today is Monday, April 1st, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time, 17 minutes past the hour. A new study outlooks at the unintended consequences of European immigration restrictions have on African migrants. Lead author of the study, Paul Bising, is a research professor at the University of Pompeu Fabra in Spain. He spoke to Ricky Stryak about the study's findings and the impact on policies and lives.
It is interesting that we have found, also other people have found this, that restrictive migration policies have other consequences on the conditions of migrations and also on the type of migrants. For instance, restrictive migrations push many immigrants to follow illegal ways of entry. And that makes, obviously, the migration process very stressful and risky for migrants. And this also kind of stigmatizes the migrants. And this has obviously negative consequences for the life of migrants, so the conditions which they integrate in the destination country. Also, this restrictive migration policies might have an intended effect in selecting the nationalities of migrants. For instance, when European countries erected these militarized and increased the restrictions in the southern borders of Europe, this obviously make much more difficult for migrants from Africa to enter Europe, but indirectly disfavored, for instance, Latin American people to enter Europe.
Do you know what kind of efforts are being made to increase legal routes to migration, if there are any efforts being made?
In fact, very, very, very little. Most of migration is labor migration, in fact. Most, if we think about European countries and also North American countries, they have very strict, very restrictive labor policies with respect to migration. They tend to accept some groups of migrants with very high skills or with very specific professions.
Another thing you looked at in your research was returnees, and on average, after 10 years, people are coming back. A high amount of migrants come back to Senegal. I think that's an underlooked part of migration.
Well, in fact, many people actually migrate have the project of coming back. In fact, the majority of people, when they migrate, they have the project of coming back. But actually, this tends to become more and more difficult. Also, coming back to restrictive migration policies, very often the fact that there are restrictive migration policies in the destination countries, this makes a lot of people reluctant to come back. because they fear that they might not be able to re-immigrate if needed, if they just don't succeed if integrating in their home country. Also, many people think about migrations that are temporary, but in fact, in the long in practice, most migrants tend to be relatively long-term.
Paul Baizan is a research professor at the University of Pompeu Fabra. He was speaking to Ricky Stryker from Barcelona. Last week, the Burundian government revoked the license of the British Broadcasting Corporation, the BBC, for airing a documentary that the government said was false and damaging to Burundi's image. The government also suspended VOA for employing a reporter who the government said opposes the government. Amnesty International has criticized the Burundian government's actions as further brazen efforts to silence the media. Innocent Muhozi is a Burundian journalist exiled in Rwanda. He was general manager of the independent Renaissance radio and television station before it was attacked and destroyed in 2015. He says what happened to the BBC and the VOA is quite normal for independent Burundian journalists.
What happened to VOA and BBC is quite normal for us because it's a situation of deep tyranny where they don't want witnesses or free media and free international observer. You see, a few times ago, they closed the office of the United Nations Human Rights Office and many others before. It's quite natural that they say they don't want Voice of America or BBC. It's exactly the same thing they did with Burundian independent media. And there might be another thing happening. This year, they are supposed to have elections, so they need to be kind of no independent observer, no independent media, so that they can manipulate everything that, like they want. We are not surprised about what happened.
Innocent, this happened to you also, but compare what the government is saying now, the fact that it has banned Burundian journalists in Burundi from reporting for, say, the Voice of America or the BBC. Compare that to also what happened to you in your own case.
You know, in our own case, if we have a reporter, for example, staying in Burundi, and that this one tried to walk and send us information, he will be either killed or put in jail automatically. It's quite clear because it's not about only closing local media or international media. It's also about and fundamentally about saying what is going on in the country. If you have Burundian reporters or no Burundian reporters in Bujumbura or in Burundi, it's the same problem. So that's why they say they cannot accept that no Burundian can work for VOA or for BBC. It's quite clear. They don't want no one to tell about what is going on freely. They just accept medias and the NGOs under their control. It's all about that.
What has been your situation now since you left Burundi? What have you been doing?
We continue to do what we've been doing in Burundi through social medias, Facebook, YouTube, websites, and we have a great, great number of Burundians following us every day. Thousands and thousands of Burundians can see what we're doing every day, even if it's prohibited, because if you caught listening to those independent media in exile, you might be in trouble, whether in jail, tortures, or other mistreatment that could happen to you. They even said it in a public meeting. The Home Affairs Minister and the Defense Minister and many other officials told people to not listen to those Burundian independent media in exile. If you caught listening to them, you're in trouble.
Okay, thank you very much again, Innocence.
Thank you, James. Thank you very much.
Innocent Muhozi is a Burundian journalist exiled in Rwanda. He was speaking with me from the capital, Kigali. Financial challenges have forced the closure of the John Garang Memorial University of Science and Technology in South Sudan. Dengai Deng reports.
Acting Vice Chancellor Wani Lado says the university administration has been compelled to close the institution because there is no money to feed the students.
Although we sacrifice teaching them without meat, it will fail most of them because they said their healthy mind is the healthy body. It's when your body is healthy, you will think very well. That is why we suspend classes. A suspension of the classes is the suspension of the academic year until further notice, until we get food.
Deng Mabur is a fourth-year student of education at Dr. John Garang Memorial University of Science and Technology. He says the closure of the university will delay his plans.
The issue of shutting down the school, suspension of classes, that has become an issue now. First of all,
who were supposed to graduate this year approximately in June or July. But just because of suspension of lectures and etc., that is now even extending us maybe approximately up to next year, of which last year we were first suspended for one semester. We never come to school. And again, this year is being suspended, of which we're not going to graduate.
Lado says he hopes the national government will find a quick solution to keep public universities operating during the school calendar.
The visits of the five universities are all in Juba. They are meeting concerning the tuition fee, and they are meeting concerning the feeding of the students. And
that was Dan Guy Dan reporting from Juba, South Sudan. Time now for Daybreak Africa. Sponsor Jerry Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you, James. We begin the sports with the CAF Super Cup, where Raja Casablanca of Morocco has won the African Super Cup after narrowly beating Tunisia's Esperance 2-1 to leave the trophy for the second time. Goals from Abdillah Hafidi, a superb first-half strike from 20 yards, and a neat close-range finish from captain Badir Benoun in the 65th minute sealed victory for Raja Casablanca. Those goals came either side of a superb goal from Esperance Mohamed Youssouf, who smashed home an equalizer in the 57th minute to give the Tunisian side a brave hope at the weekend. The Super Cup is an annual one-off match pitting the winner of the CAF Champions League and the second-tier CAF Confederations Cup against each other. Friday's match was played in the 2022 World Cup host nation Qatar, the first time it has been played outside Africa. Here's how some fans reacted to Raja's victory.
It just continued to show the dominance of the Northern African club sides on the continent and football in general in Africa.
We expected a good contest, and I think it was a good display for African football.
Away from football to volleyball, where the 38th edition of the Men's African Volleyball Club Championship will see record holders and reigning champions Al Ahly of Egypt defend their title against 22 teams across the continent when the showpiece serve off later tonight in Cairo, Egypt. Among the 22 teams to participate, only Al Ahly ever lay hand on the coveted title, and should they fail to defend the title, a new champion will be crowned. Kenya Prisons coach David Longhau has backed his charges to progress from a tricky-looking Group C.
So what you're going to do is that you're going to take one match at a time, and I want to promise Kenyans that you're going to do our best to see that we advance to the next stage.
In athletics news, Athletics Kenya president Jackson Tui has criticized the International Association of Athletics Federation decision to drop 5,000 meters and 10,000 meters event in the Diamond League, in which African athletes have traditionally done very well, describing the decision as unfair. IWAF President Sebastian Coe and CEO John Ridgeon met Jackson Tui during the World Cross Country Championships in Ahaus and provided assurances that Kenyan and other East African athletes will not be disadvantaged. Sebastian Coe clarified that the absence of the 5,000 meters from the official program will not prevent individual Diamond League meetings from running the event outside of the 90-minute broadcast window. Deji Ogunbo is an athletic sports reporter.
The president's Lord Sebastian Coe eased their fears, saying that despite them removing those events, they will still inculcate them into some other series, which a lot of meets have been dying to have them, something like the IWF Challenge meet, as well as some other meets around the world. So it's still a win-win situation.
That's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And that is it for this Monday, April 1st edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Barton, Washington, hoping that you will have a productive day.
VOA welcomes Sun FM in Zambia as its newest partner. VOA's popular programs, including Daybreak Africa, Africa News Tonight, the 5-minute newscast on the top of the hour, and of course, VOA Music Mix, can all be heard now on Sun FM, 88.5 on the Copper Belt, 95.1 and 95.5 FM in Central Province, 95.3 in Lusaka Province, and 91.7 FM in Livingston. Welcome to the VOA Radio affiliate family.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On April 7th, the United Nations marks the 25th anniversary of the genocide in Rwanda. More than 800,000 people, mostly Tutsi, were killed. An in-depth discussion of what Rwanda and the world has learned from this tragedy on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.